So, if you'd like to turn to Sutta 118, I believe, Anapanasati Sutta, it's on page 941 of the books. Okay, everyone come in and settle down. Okay, so let us begin. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. The Anapanasati Sutta, number 118, the Majjhima Nikaya, is, in my opinion, it's the Buddha's explanation of meditation in full, the very deep and elaborate description of what happens when you meditate. And I know this sutta extremely well, and so we're going to go through it and just show just how deep it becomes and how all-embracing it is. When we come to the end, the Buddha makes some very interesting statements, and especially because sometimes that people equate Anapanasati with the Samatha tradition, and they say it's opposed to the Vipassana tradition, and at the end we can see that argument completely demolished by the Buddha to show there is no difference between Satipatthana and Vipassana and Anapanasati, all the same. So listen out, because this is what we're going to find out. So as usual, I'm going to go through a little bit and then pause if anyone has any comments. Do you want to use this one? Or this one? Yes. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sawati in the eastern park in the palace of Migara's mother, that's Visakha, together with many very well-known elder disciples, Sariputta, Mahamoggallana, Mahakassapa, Mahakachana, Mahakotita, Mahakapina, the Venerable Mahachunda, the Venerable Anuruddha, Venerable Revata, Venerable Ananda, and other very well-known elder disciples. This obviously shows that this occurred in the later part of the Buddha's dispensation. Now, on that occasion, elder bhikkhus have been teaching and instructing new bhikkhus. Some elder bhikkhus have been teaching and instructing 10 new bhikkhus, 20, 30, 40 new bhikkhus. Bhikkhus means monks. And the new monks taught and instructed by the elder bhikkhus had achieved successive stages of high distinction. On that occasion, the Upasatha day of the 15th, on the full moon night of the Pavarana ceremony, that's the full moon which ends the rains retreat, the Blessed One was seated in the open, surrounded by the Sangha of bhikkhus. Then, surveying the silent Sangha of bhikkhus, he addressed them thus, "Bhikkhus, I am content with this progress. My mind is content with this progress. So arouse still more energy to attain the unattained, to achieve the unachieved, to realize the unrealized. I shall wait here at Sawati for the Kamudu full moon of the fourth month," in other words, for another 1 month. The monks of the countryside heard the Blessed One will wait at Sawati for another month, and the monks from the countryside left in due course for Sawati to see the Blessed One. And the elder, if anyone knows where Sawati is, it's on the Nepalese-Indian border, on the Indian side, and it's a very beautiful place. You can go there today. And elder monks still more intensively taught and instructed new monks, and some elder monks taught 10 monks, some taught 20, 30, 40 new monks, and the new monks taught and instructed by these elder bhikkhus achieved successive stages of high distinction. And on that occasion, the Upasatha day of the 15th, the full moon night of the Kamudi full moon, that's 1 month after the rains retreat, that's usually around about November full moon, the Blessed One was seated in the open, surrounded by the Sangha of bhikkhus. Then, surveying the silent Sangha of monks, he addressed them thus, "Monks, this assembly is free from prattle," that means idle talk. "This assembly is free from chatter. It consists purely of heartwood. Such is the Sangha of bhikkhus, such is this assembly, such an assembly as is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitalities, of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, an incomparable field of merit for the world. Such is this Sangha of monks, Such is this assembly. Such an assembly that a small gift given to it becomes great, according to the law of karma. And a greater gift. Such is this Sangha of Bhikkhus, such is this assembly. Such an assembly as is rare for the world to see, such is this Sangha of monks, such is this assembly. Such an assembly as would be worthy journeying many leagues with a travel bag to see, you would call with a backpack. Such is this Sangha of monks, such is this assembly. In this Sangha of monks there are monks who are arahats, fully enlightened with their taints destroyed, who have lived a holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, beautiful saying, lay down the burden of attachment. Just like you've been journeying a long time through life, through many lives, and carrying this very heavy weight, and finally you've found out what that weight is, and you put it down. You've laid down the burden. Free. Reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and are completely liberated through final knowledge. Such monks are there in this Sangha of monks, the arahats. In this Sangha of monks are bhikkhus who, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, are due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes, the heaven realms for the anagamis, and there they will attain nibbana, never ever being reborn from that world. Such monks are there in this Sangha of monks. In this Sangha of bhikkhus there are monks who, with the destruction of the three fetters and with the attenuation of lust and hate and delusion, they are once returners, returning only once to this world. They go to a heaven realm, and then they come back to this realm where they become fully enlightened. Such monks are there in this Sangha of monks. In this Sangha of monks are monks who, with the destruction of the three fetters, are stream enterers, no longer subject to the lower realms, perdition, bound for deliverance, headed for enlightenment. Such monks are there in this Sangha of monks. In this Sangha of monks are monks who are by devoted to the development of the four foundations of mindfulness. Such monks are there in this Sangha of monks. In this Sangha of monks are monks who are by devoted to the development of the four kinds of striving, the four bases for spiritual power, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven enlightenment factors, the noble eightfold path. Such monks are there in this Sangha of monks. In this Sangha of monks are bhikkhus who are by devoted to the development of loving kindness, to compassion, to appreciative joy, to equanimity, or to the meditation on foulness, the perception of impermanence. Such monks are in this Sangha of bhikkhus. In this Sangha of bhikkhus there are bhikkhus who abide devoted to the development of mindfulness of breathing. That's the prologue. That's why I went through it reasonably quickly. So it's just the Buddha being inspired by his disciples at that time. And now leading on, seeing all their attainments, and now the practices which they were doing, ending up with the development of mindfulness of breathing. As the introduction to a full discourse on what actually is mindfulness of breathing. I went through that very quickly, so are there any comments on what I've just been saying, or questions? Okay, let's get into the nitty-gritty then of mindfulness of breathing. Monks, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. When the four foundations of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven enlightenment factors. And when the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge and deliverance. In other words, full enlightenment. So how is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and benefit? And here we go. Number one, here's paragraph 17. Here a monk gone to the forest, or to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut, sits down, having folded their legs crosswise, set their body erect, and establish mindfulness in front of them. Ever mindful they breathe in, mindful they breathe out. Now pause, because each one of these paragraphs I'm going to analyze. First of all, sometimes when we meditate, we think that we should be able to meditate anywhere. Just meditate in the middle of the market, meditate in the noisy places. But the Buddha's advice would always be, when you start, to go to a forest. Literally means, the word for forest was aranyaka, means like a desolate place. a place which is away from things. Like a forest, it says here, or to the root of a tree, to an empty heart. I don't like that translation. Sunyagare is much more than an empty heart. It just means an empty place, an empty abiding, anywhere where you can find a little bit of solitude, a quiet place. Not necessarily an empty hut, but just like a quiet abiding. So you go and find quietness first of all. You sit down, having folded your legs crosswise, and you set your body erect, just looking after your bodily posture. In these days, the Buddha would say, you find a nice meditation stool or cushion or even a chair, wherever you can actually sit comfortably. This is attending to posture. And establish mindfulness in front of them, ever mindful they breathe in, ever mindful they breathe out. Now this, of course, is the most important part of beginning one's meditation practice, to establish mindfulness in front of them. Now what does it mean to be mindful? Obviously, to be mindful means you have to be in the present moment. If you're wondering about what's happened or allowing the mind to go off into the future, you are not being mindful of what's happening now. So this is the first thing. It has to be mindfulness of the present moment. And if you're thinking a lot, even though you may be thinking about what's happening now, again, that is not being fully mindfulness in the moment. So, to be mindful, present moment, silence. And that is establishing mindfulness in front of you. Once you have that, then you can mindfully breathe in and breathe out. Because if you're thinking about something else, you cannot know what the breath is doing. If you're off into the future, you don't know if you're breathing in or breathing out now. If you're worrying about the past, how can you know what's happening with your breath in the moment? So you've all heard mentioning these two early parts of meditation, present moment awareness and silence. In the Anapanasati Sutta, this is where they come in. Establishing mindfulness. In the system which I teach, we make a lot of emphasis on that original, or that sort of beginning part of meditation, because if you don't get a solid foundation in mindfulness to begin with, then the rest of the meditation gets very difficult. Any comments on that? Okay, let's go on to the next. Breathing in long, they understand I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, they understand I breathe out long. Breathing in short, one understands I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, one understands I breathe out short. I pause there. Because usually the Anapanasati Sutta, they say this 16 steps. This is usually the way it's related. This is step number one, breathing in long, you understand I breathe in long. Breathing out long, you understand I breathe out long. Breathing in short, one understands one breathes in short. Breathing out short, one understands one breathes out short. So this is the first two steps, one and two. What it really means, it's very clear, is when you're breathing in, you know if it's a long breath, you know it's a short breath. It doesn't mean that these two steps have to be done one after the other. It doesn't mean that if you're breathing in short, then you have to stop and try and breathe in a long breath. It doesn't mean that if you're breathing in long, then you have to eventually pass to breathing in short. This is just a way of getting you in contact with your breath, giving it a bit of interest, making it have a bit more texture, so that the mind has something to work with. This is making the breath interesting, finding out whether it's long or short. One of the little tricks we sometimes teach is it's not breathing in and breathing out, because there's gaps between the in-breath and the out-breath. When the in-breath finishes, the out-breath is yet to begin. When the out-breath finishes and the in-breath hasn't started yet, there's always those pauses. And sometimes we ask the students to notice which one is the longest. The gap between the in and the out breath, or the out and the in breath. All this really means is it makes it interesting. You've got something to look for. Instead of just saying be aware of the breath, you become aware of some quality of the breath which anchors your attention to this breath. Other times we give other ways of visualizing the breath or making it interesting, such as imagining this breath carries the oxygen from the trees and the flowers and everything which is green, because that's where the oxygen is replenished from. And every time you breathe out, you're breathing out carbon dioxide as your gift to nature, because that's what nature needs to survive. So that way you can actually contemplate that your breath is connecting with everything which is green in the world. And that also makes the breath interesting. So these first two stages, instead of just breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, it makes it interesting. So you can either do, see whether it's a long breath or a short breath or somewhere in between, or you can maybe do that, you're breathing in, imagining oxygen from the trees and the flowers, and breathing out, giving your gift to the greenery. You can do that, because that makes it interesting. There's many other things you can do. You can imagine the breath like some child which is giving you life as you breathe in and breathe out. You're looking after this amazing thing we call the breath. We call it like anthropomorphizing, making a non-being and some process, giving it a name, giving it a sense of like it's a living being which we care for. So these are all ways of just getting you in touch with the breath. Now, any questions on those first two stages? First one was bringing up mindfulness. Now, making the breath interesting by giving it some sort of commentary or giving it some sort of texture. Something the mind can latch onto. Any comments about that? Yeah. Yes, very good, thank you. That's another way of doing counting along with the breath, and there's no end of ways to do counting with the breath. When I first learned meditation, there was a very skillful technique, but it was quite complex. Is that you breathe in a long breath, the longest comfortable breath you can possibly breathe in, and then you count, you measure that according to the count of nine. So one, two, you know, breathing in one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. So just the right length and the counting, just so you finish nine at the end of the in breath, and then as you breathe out, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Keep on doing that, so you've got the nine breath. And then you do a shorter breath to the count of six, breathing in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The same sort of rhythm, and then a shorter breath to 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1. 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1. Just messing around with the length and the shortness of the breath. I said even you can try sometimes just one, like very short breaths, and then find the one which is most comfortable to for you. And because just in one in-breath you're counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, one in-breath becomes so much to do. It becomes so many things the mind has to count, that it's very difficult to lose your mindfulness of your breath. You always tend to keep it in mind. That is one way of counting. I thought that's a bit too disturbing, but other people might like it. And then the way I usually teach, the way I usually do any counting, I just breathing in one, breathing out one. Just one for each in breath, one for each out breath. Then breathing in two, out two, in three, out three. And I think many of you have heard how I do that in my retreats. Up to 9, then 1 to 8, 1 to 7, 1 to 6, 1 to 5, 1 to 4, 1 to 3, 1 to 2. And breathing in 1, breathing out 1. Finishing a whole cycle of 45 breaths. That's also making the breath interesting. Is that quite clear? Okay. So you get your mindfulness onto that breath. Now the next stage, one trains oneself thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the whole body of the breath. One trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the whole body of the breath. That's stage number 3, experiencing the whole body of the breath. Now you've got to be careful here, because some people who don't know Pali, sometimes they think you're experiencing the whole body. Unfortunately, some teachers I've heard actually say that, and it's obviously so clearly wrong. A body in Pali means the same as a body in English. You have things like a body of evidence, a body of truth, a body of soldiers. It just means any group of things, any conglomeration of things. And so this just means all those things which make up a breath, this is the whole body of the breath. And what it means is one sees the breath from the very beginning of an in-breath, right to the end of an in-breath. One sees the gap in between. One sees from the very beginning of an out-breath to the end of the out-breath, this continual awareness of the breath, which is the whole body of the breath. You can understand where this comes from now. You're starting off just by getting some mindfulness. Then you watch the breath and you make it sort of interesting by adding things like counting or imagining it's bringing oxygen, connecting you with nature. And once you've got the breath there, then you fill up all of the moments of consciousness with the experiencing of the breath. When you're counting the breath, sometimes you're breathing in one, then you can let go and be aware of something else for a while until you can catch the out breath coming soon later. But here, on this stage, page number 3, from the very beginning of an in-breath, you can see that right to the end of an in-breath, without missing a moment. From the very beginning of an out-breath, right to the end of an out-breath, you see every moment of the breath without missing it. That's why we call it experiencing the whole body of the breath. It's as you train yourself to do this, so you manage to learn how to watch the breath without missing a beat. This is the third stage of the Anapanasati. Lots of the time these things happen quite naturally. You find as you calm down, as you're letting go, you find that first of all, when you first watch the breath, you maybe watch a breath here, a breath there, as other things start to come into the mind. As you slow down, as you calm down, you start to be aware much more of the breath. Until you come to the stage where you're just watching the breath, it fills every moment. You may be able to hear some other sounds or feelings in the body, but they're in the background and they never really disturb the main focus of attention, which is your breath. Full awareness from the beginning to the end of each in-breath, beginning to the end of each out-breath. So you're fully aware of the breath. Is that clear? Any questions on that? So you're not watching your body, you're watching the breath. Next stage is stage number 4. You train thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the body formation. Once you train thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. And that bodily formation is explained as just the breath. As in other suttas, you mentioned that that is what it means in this context. So you're not tranquilizing, because that gives the idea of you giving yourself some sort of injection and putting yourself to sleep. It's a much better word to say calming the breath. Prasambayang is the Pali word. Calming it, settling it down. So the first thing in stage number 3, you've got to get hold of the breath. Make sure you can experience the whole breath from the beginning to the end. Once you've got the breath in mind, from that point you start to calm it down. There's an old saying, if you want to train a tiger, you've got to catch the tiger first of all. If you want to train an elephant, you've got to maybe have it in your command first of all, before you can train it. If you're going to calm the breath, you have to have the full breath in mind before you start calming it. That's why stage 3 has to come before stage 4. So you don't calm the breath until it's fully in mind. Because sometimes people do that, they miss out and they do stage 4 before stage 3. They calm it down until before they've got the full awareness of the breath. And then they just get lost. Any question on that? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. Yes, okay. What are you doing there? They're expressing the goal. that you know, I should get to that stage of being able to breathe in, calming the whole breath, breathe out, just calming the whole breath. That's the goal, that's the explanation of the goal. How you achieve that, the means, is through letting go. As you know, I've explained many, many times. If you say, right, okay, I'm going to breathe in and breathe out, calm in this breath, okay, come on. You never calm anything that way, as you all know. So you're expressing the goal, but the means to it is obviously the letting go and abandoning. That's the way these things calm down. No, that's the way it's translated. Pali, yeah. Because the word is just bhavisami. It's almost, the future tense is sometimes almost like a wish. It's not a sort of like a controlling. It's almost like a suggestion. It's almost like a may I. And like a resolution. This is where I'm going. This is where I want to be. But it's not actually making a controlling. It's a future tense, it's not an imperative tense. Imperative means an order. It's almost like a wish. It's much softer than a controlling. And they always have to have, you know, some sense. The verbs always have to have an I in there somewhere, but it's not sort of emphasized or stressed. So, you know, just, you're not actually giving an order, I will do this. It's almost like, may I be able to watch the breath as it goes in, may I be able to watch the whole breath as it go out. Yeah, you get the wrong context, but it's very good to actually to set out the stages. Set out the, it's almost it's as if it's like a goal. But it's a goal achieved through letting go. And it's useful because I shall be the experience in the whole body of the breath. I shall be that experience in the whole body of breath. It shows you what the stages are. You can aspire towards those stages. You finally reach those stages through letting go. Or, as you know, that sometimes you can make an aspiration at the beginning, or even during the meditation, this is where I'm going next, using that old simile of the taxi driver. You have to tell the taxi driver where you want to go when you get in the car, otherwise you won't go anywhere. But you don't keep on interrupting the taxi driver every 2 minutes. It's an old metaphor I've given. Imagine you're going from this place to Perth International Airport to catch a plane to go somewhere. And as soon as you get into the taxi, you tell the taxi driver, look, I want to get to Perth Airport. I've got to get there quickly, but don't go too fast. I don't want you to drive too far to the left nor too far to the right. Now drive slowly in the middle. Please give way if you sort of see any cars coming in the way because, you know, I'm a Buddhist and I'm supposed to be compassionate. And please make sure you don't sort of hit any cats which are going around and don't sort of honk your horn too much. And if you sort of start talking like that to a taxi driver, even before you get out the gate, you know, he's going to sort of throw you out. He said, just tell me where you want to go. I know how to drive. I know how to get there. Don't tell me my job. All you need to do with a taxi driver is just make a suggestion. You get a taxi, I need to get to Perth Airport. And then you shut up. Once you're quiet, the taxi driver will take you to where you want to go. You don't always need to keep interrupting. Control freak means that you keep interrupting every few minutes. Come on, I shall breathe in and experience the whole body of breath. I shall breathe in, come on, experience the whole body of the breath. Come on, do this. Don't experience the whole body of the breath this way, experiencing it that way. This is what the monk said, but this is what somebody else said. If you keep on interrupting yourself, you never get anywhere. That's where the control freak comes in. But you may even make a resolution. Okay, I shall breathe in experiencing the whole body of the breath. And then you shut up. You told the taxi driver, and then you let the taxi driver do the job. But if you don't tell the taxi driver anything, you sit in the back of the cab, and where do you want to go? Let go, let go, let go, let go. You never get anywhere. I hope that answers the question as best I possibly can. Thanks for the good question. And what tranquilizing the bodily function, what does that actually mean, or calming it down? You can understand just what a rough breath feels like. You're breathing in, breathing out. It's rough, it's fast, and it's uncomfortable. As you calm the breath down, you're breathing in so smoothly, it becomes comfortable, It becomes even enjoyable. It becomes effortless. It becomes smooth. This is all what we mean by calming it down. It's like a person, the similar I usually give as a child, you're trying to settle them down in bed at night. And if you want your child to go to sleep at night, you don't grab them by the throat, throttle them and give them dire words. Listen, fellow, if you don't go to bed soon, if you don't go to sleep soon, you're going to be in big trouble. Now go to sleep or else. Because that just winds the poor little child up. He never go to sleep. He's scared stiff of what you're going to do. That's not the way you calm a child down so they can fall asleep. Nor is it the way you calm yourself down if you're going to go to sleep at night. Because sometimes you may have had a busy day and you might get a bit upset and find it hard to go to sleep at night. And if you keep saying, come on, I must go to sleep. I've got to get to sleep. I've got to get up early in the morning. I've got lots to do. Come on, I must get to sleep. You never get to sleep that way. So you've got to treat yourself like a small child. Come on, go to sleep. Shh. Everything's all right. Tell yourself a nice little story. And then halfway through the story, you go to sleep. Like it's calming the breath down. That's how we do it, gently. Until the breath becomes very, very smooth. Remember, you're already watching the whole breath. Now you're calming it down. So the first thing is it becomes gentle, smooth, even beautiful. The next thing which happens when you calm the breath down, it also means simplifying it. So tranquilizing, calming, simplifying. Also means that when you begin to watch the breath, you are supposed to see the whole body, the breath, from the beginning to the end, to the end to the beginning, see the gaps in between. But when it calms down and becomes simplified, many aspects of the breath disappear. There's a great simile which is used in the commentaries about a person, a carpenter, who is sawing a piece of wood. And that carpenter, as he saws that piece of wood, with not with a rotary saw, electric saw, just with old-fashioned saws, if anyone is old enough to remember those. And as you push the saw down to cut it, as you draw it back, it's like similar to the breath going in, the breath going out, up and down. And as your saw strokes, you know, the beginning of the saw stroke right to the end of the downstroke, the backstroke from the beginning to the end of the backstroke. And all the time, the carpenter just watching, just the point where the saw touches the wood. And when you first do this, you know from the beginning of the saw stroke to the end of the saw stroke. But as you focus and things simplify, after a while the carpenter doesn't know whether it's the beginning of the saw stroke or the end of the saw stroke. Because all you see is just one or two saw teeth. Until you really don't know whether it's the beginning or the end, or what part of the saw stroke it is. In the same way with the breath, you come to the point when you simplify things down, when all you know is just this part of the breath happening now. You don't even know if it's the beginning or the end, if it's going in or going out. The breath has been calmed down and simplified to just breath happening. In and out have faded away. You've simplified. You've calmed it down. Sometimes it's like simplifying and calming down people when they come on a meditation retreat. The men and the women tend to dress in white, and the differences between them start to disappear. And sometimes on a retreat, if people are wearing these shabby white clothes, you don't know who's the man and who's the woman. As you simplify things down, you don't know in-breath or out-breath. They all tend to look the same. Calming, simplifying. That's the stage of the meditation. Until you get to the stage, just this breath happening now. And you don't know whether it's in or whether it's out. It's just breath. Any questions on that? There's also the other part of simplifying or calming the breath down is you're not really quite sure where that breath is happening. You notice we're watching the breath here, it doesn't say anywhere in this text to watch the breath at the nose, nor does it say to watch it at the tip of the nose, or the bridge of the nose, or at the throat, or the stomach, or anywhere. One just knows the breath, that's all. And especially at this stage, when everything starts to calm down and things get simplified, it does become a disembodied breath, is the word I use. A breath which is not linked to any part of the body. You know the breath is happening, but the perception of where it's happening in your body has completely disappeared. You don't know, you don't care, it's irrelevant. You've simplified things down. In the same way that sometimes you're sitting in meditation and you know you're here, but you're not quite sure whether you're in the left part of the hall or the back of the hall or the middle of the hall, because that perception has become irrelevant. You're just sitting here, quite happy, very mindful, but the perception of where you're sitting has disappeared. Sometimes you're sitting in meditation so quietly peaceful, so you have to open your eyes to remember whether you're in the monastery or in Singapore or somewhere else. It becomes irrelevant where you are. In the same way, it becomes irrelevant whether the breath is happening at the nose or anywhere else. This is all part of that fourth stage, simplifying, calming the breath. One of the most important. That's okay. Let's get to the fifth stage, because this is where things start to warm up. They train us, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture. One trains us, I shall breathe out experiencing rapture. Six, one trains us, I shall breathe in experiencing pleasure. One trains us, I shall breathe out experiencing pleasure. And this starts to look fun, rapture and pleasure. Now what happens now is, again, very often this happens naturally, as you calm the breath down, as it simplifies, it starts to get beautiful. And the reason why it starts to get beautiful, why these things happen naturally anyway, is that when all of your energy of your being goes into mindfulness, simplified, it doesn't go into thinking or changing or working, and all the energy going into mindfulness, the mind brightens up. It's as if the lights in the mind get brighter. What you see, you can actually see with more subtly, and things start to become more beautiful. After a meditation retreat, or a good meditation, people often go outside, the leaves look greener, the sky looks more blue, everything seems to be polished and bright and shining. No one's gone out and done that, it's just your mind has become more alert, more awake, it's seeing much more. And what you see is always more beautiful. In this case, what you're seeing is the breath, and the breath is starting to become beautiful. It's actually mentioned earlier, just as an aside, that the monks sometimes, in the Sangha bhikkhus, there are monks doing the meditation on foulness. Meditation on foulness is sometimes they do like on a skull or on a bone. But sometimes you think, oh, that must be a rotten thing to do, just meditating on a skull all day. But what actually happens? It's amazing. You're meditating on the skull, and when your mind becomes very bright, the skull becomes beautiful. Wow, what a wonderful, amazing thing. That becomes like a flower. It goes brilliant, shining. The most beautiful piece of bone you've ever seen in your whole life. Oh, that's delicious. It's not that monks are weird. It's just, this is what happens when you meditate. Whatever you watch becomes the most beautiful thing. Even if it's just a lump of chicken shit or something, it becomes, oh, look at that, isn't that amazing, wonderful? Because this is just what the mind does. So it's at this point where, as the mindfulness increases, pleasure and rapture come up into the mind. If it doesn't come up naturally, one can try and encourage it a little bit. One of the techniques I've been encouraging people to do recently in their meditation, if when they've got to the stage of they've calmed down the breath and the happiness is not really happening, put aside the breath for 1 or 2 seconds, put your attention on your facial muscles and smile. Do a controlled smile. Because when you do a controlled smile, interrupt meditation, as soon as you smile, the mind reacts. What you do with your body sometimes affects the mind. What the mind does affects the body. And that sort of triggers a little bit of happiness in the meditation. It's important actually to even have that instruction there, because sometimes people think meditation shouldn't be happy and they get a bit afraid when happiness comes. Here, you're supposed to do this. This is part of the meditation. It's supposed to have some rapture and pleasure coming up. As many of you have been telling me over the last couple of weeks, there was a program on the television about the happiest monkey in the world. Now you see why. It's here in the book. This is the stage 5 and 6. And there's still lots more to come yet. So this is where you start getting blissed out. And this is where you start experiencing rapture and pleasure. The breath starts to appear very, very beautiful. The experience is very, very beautiful. So, and then the next stage is I shall breathe in, train myself that I shall breathe in, experiencing the mental formation. I shall breathe out, experiencing the mental formation. That mental formation is just that happiness and pleasure coming together. And say, once you've aroused the happiness and pleasure, now you just spend your time experiencing that. Not the breath anymore. You're focusing on the pleasure, on the happiness, the beauty. So it's as if there's a little bit of a flip here from noticing the breath to noticing that aspect of the breath, which is the beautiful part, and allowing that to fill the mind. Sometimes around this stage, people start to wonder, I've lost the breath. I don't know whether I'm breathing in or breathing out. And so that's great, you're supposed to lose the breath. And in its place, have it replaced by happiness. Sometimes people lose the breath, and it's replaced just by peace, by a sense of quietness. And that is a mistake in the meditation, because it doesn't take you any further. And I tell many people, if the breath disappears and it's very, very peaceful and still, but there's no real pleasure and rapture there, you'll find you won't be able to go any deeper. And I tell people, put aside that peace, take up the breath again, and this time don't let it go until it's very, very beautiful. It's as if you're making rapture and pleasure with the breath. When it's enough rapture and pleasure, then the breath disappears, you're left with the rapture and pleasure. That's actually a mistake which many people go. They get to a plateau, very lovely, nice and peaceful, having a reasonably good time, but they can't take it further. So they have to go back a little bit and just get rapture and pleasure up so they don't let go of the breath until it's really nice. This is lovely, having a wonderful time. You know you've got rapture and pleasure coming up if the monk or the nun rings the bell and thinks, I don't want that to happen. Then you know it's enjoyable. But if you can't wait for the bell to go, then it's not rapture and pleasure. And the next stage, this is number 8, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the mental formation. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the mental formation. This is again when you start to make calm, simplicity. So you've got this beautiful happiness and peace, and you just allow it to settle down. So you're at peace with it, and it's at peace with you. So this stage, you're just feeling, having a wonderful time, just meditating there. The mind is full of happiness. That's its main object, not the breath now. You may be aware of the breath, but the breath is not the main object. The main object you're aware of is the happiness in the meditation. Just the joy. Is that quite clear? I mentioned afterwards that those 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th stages, that's where the main object is Vedana, the happiness, the pleasure, not the breath anymore. Now we get to the really interesting stuff. I shall breathe in, experiencing the mind. Yidam trains us. I shall breathe out, experiencing the mind. This is the first time in meditation, or probably your life, where you start to experience the mind. Many people would actually write essays about the mind. There are TV programs about the mind. Scientists trying to find out what the mind is. And this is how you experience the mind. As you're calming down the mind in this pleasure situation, this is where the meditator starts to experience what in meditation parlance we call the nimittas, the beautiful lights which come up into the mind at this time. When the mind becomes bright and lights appear in the mind, that which you see is a reflection of your mind. Usually it's beautiful light which comes up. If it's not enough pleasure, first of all, enough joy, that light doesn't come up. If you haven't tranquilized enough, and that light comes up, it just flashes and disappears very quickly. But if you followed all the steps and done it properly, then when that light comes up, and it's very beautiful and very intense and very powerful. That is experiencing your mind. That's how it's perceived. And it's very fascinating also because sometimes when that nimitta, that image in your meditation comes up, it looks dirty and grubby. And people say, oh, what's going on here? I can't see this beautiful light, all I see is this grubby old light. And I say that that's a reflection of your mind. What have you been doing? And it's always the case that if a people have been living sort of a heedless lifestyle, if they've been arguing or kicking the cat or something, then this is what they see. This is a time of automatic honesty. You're actually seeing what your mind is like. But if you've been a pure living person, a kind person, the sort of person which is saying that they are a naturally good person, always willing to help, never saying a bad word about anything, anybody, always kind, generous, helpful. You know those sorts of people. The sort of people you love to be around. They're always just so selfless. Then, when they come across their mind, it's bright and beautiful. So this is where honesty comes in. And this is why that sometimes it's good to keep things like precepts, to be good things, to do dana, to help, to serve, because you're brightening up your mind. And when you come to this stage, you find that you're at an advantage. This is what I mean by experiencing the mind. Now, sometimes that nimitta comes up and it doesn't last, or sometimes it's not bright enough to go further. So what do we do? The next stages are the 10th and 11th. One trains us. I shall breathe in gladdening the mind. I shall breathe out gladdening the mind. I shall breathe in concentrating the mind. I shall breathe out concentrating the mind. That's the translations there. Gladdening the mind means actually bringing more joy. It's pamojayang. Not really gladdening the mind, but more like, I like to call it like shining up the nimitta, making it brighter, making it more beautiful. And concentrating the mind, that word concentrating is being overused. It means stilling, stabilizing that nimitta, making it still. So the first one is actually brightening up the mind, making, in other words, this nimitta which comes up, making it more and more beautiful, more bright, more brilliant. And the second is actually keeping it still. Because those are the two problems at this stage. When you get to this stage of the meditation, you're not aware of the body, you're not aware of sound, all those things are gone, all you're aware of this beautiful light in the mind. And in order to take it further, to make it just this beautiful mind, gladden it, shining it up. And there's many techniques for that. One of the best techniques for that is always looking in the middle of the nimitta. Because that's where always where the brightest and most beautiful part is. It's never just the same intensity all over. Just look in the middle, and there in the middle you get the brightest part. And if it's going to work, as if that brightest part expands and you can go into the middle of the brightest part, always going in middle, 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 and the intensity starts to increase and increase and increase. When you have nimittas coming up, these lights in the mind, never go looking at the edges. Because in the edges it's just too much going on. There's an inside and outside. And you're worrying about what the shape is, whether it's clear or whatever. And that is just too much disturbance. Always go to the center. As you're going into the center, it's also the brightest part. On the edges, it's never as bright. So it's always looking in the middle. Sometimes that people get, instead of like a nimitta which appears as a star or as a like the moon, sometimes you get a sheet of light. And I was telling someone recently, when that happens, go in the middle of that sheet of light. There's always the brightest little spot there, almost like a circle on this sheet of light. And there, you can actually start getting to the brightening of the mind. Until the nimitta becomes so bright, just like, you know, brighter than looking at the sun. You're not looking at these things with your eyes. This is the mind consciousness at this particular stage. So the eyes are not seeing anything, and it becomes so beautiful, because in Pamujayang is a sense of joy, happiness, brilliance. It becomes incredibly beautiful and full of lots of happiness. And when this is one of the problems, because sometimes that we don't know how to take so much happiness, and we start getting trembling. Which is why the next stage is important, which is Samadhang Chittang. Here it said concentrating the mind means keeping it still, tranquilizing it, allowing it to be still. And what's happening here, the way we allow it to be still, I've used the best simile which I've come across for this, is you're looking at yourself in a mirror early in the morning, and you want the image in the mirror to be still, and it's shaking backwards and forwards. So you think the way to make that mirror still is to grab hold of the mirror and stop the mirror shaking. Doesn't matter how still you hold the mirror, if the one inside is moving backwards and forwards, so will the image which you see be moving backwards and forwards. It's not the mirror's fault, it's the one who's looking. That's in the same way that to calm down, to tranquilize or to still the nimitta which arises at this state, it means the one who is watching has to be still. So you put your attention on the one which is watching and allow that just to settle down, become even more still, and then your nimitta will become still. This is where we're working with this very, very refined object, the nimitta in the mind. And we get to the 12th stage, which again happens naturally. At this time, even though it says I shall train myself this might be what you say as an aspiration before you even start. If you start doing this aspiration at this stage, everything's going to fall apart. One trains oneself thus, I should breathe in liberating the mind. I should breathe out liberating the mind. Liberating the mind is where the mind becomes completely free from the body, completely free from hearing, from seeing, smelling, tasting, and from touching. The experience will always be the person actually either feeling that the one who knows just dives and merges into that nimitta, or the nimitta coming and enveloping you, and going into the state of the mind's freedom of the first jhana. This is where the jhana states begin. The jhanas in Pali are called the freedoms, the liberations. This is why it means liberating the mind here. Arising the jhanas. Those jhanas that many of you have heard me write about, heard me talk about, have read in the little booklets which I've written. Those jhanas can be known when there's no way in the world you can hear anything. Someone can kick you and you wouldn't feel it. Enormous bliss, absolute stillness, you cannot think. There's no possibility of words at that time. Beautifully, ecstatically still. If anyone has those jhanas, they have a silly smile on their face for hours afterwards. If anyone comes and they have a horizontal mouth and they say, I've just been in jhana, I don't believe them. They go, oh, it's like when a person, like a teenager, falls in love, only sort of magnified many times. Oh, it's wonderful. Oh. That's more like it. And this is what it means by, I shall breathe out, in and out, liberating the mind. The 12th stage of Anapanasati. So those first 12 stages are all teaching you how to use the breath as a vehicle for getting into jhanas. The first four is just working with the breath, which is why later on you find that that part is called the first satipatthana, the body awareness. The next four, where you get the pleasure and the joy coming up, rapture I think he calls it, and feeling the whole pleasure enwrapped and then calming it down. That's the Vedana, the second Satipatthana. And the third is the Chitta Satipatthana, the third Satipatthana. We're working with the mind itself. And this is what the mind actually is. Experienced as a nimitta, this beautiful light in the mind. You're not experiencing the body at this time. You're not experiencing sounds and feelings in the body. That's all disappeared. Otherwise it would not be included as a third Satipatthana. This is actually where you're liberating things. Any questions on this? Okay, now we go into the insight practices here. Well, that's all insight practices. This is where we get the wisdom practices. He trains us, or she trains us. So I shall breathe in and out, contemplating impermanence. I shall breathe in and out, contemplating fading away. I shall breathe in and out, contemplating cessation. I shall breathe in and out, contemplating relinquishment. This, again, there is a sequence of this after those jhanas. One reflects on impermanence. One reflects on fading away. One reflects on cessation. One reflects on relinquishing. And what do those mean? Impermanence, one is reflecting on something which is not just rising and falling, rising and falling. One is reflecting on things which once were there and have now completely disappeared. The similes which I've used, it's like watching your television. You see programs come and programs go. You see channels changing. You see even sometimes when the television is turned off. Now there's a program, now there's not. You see the change on the television. But that's not the full story of impermanence. It's when you're watching the television, and not just the program disappears, not just the sound turns off, but the whole television vanishes. The whole set disappears into nothingness, and there's no television set there anymore. Now that would actually really challenge you, wouldn't it? If you're watching a television and it suddenly disappears, because certainly that's not covered in the warranty. It's not what you expect to happen. Television's just vanishing out of existence. And this is what we mean about the contemplating impermanence. Things which you always thought were there now have disappeared. Now what's disappeared? How many have been in the jhanas? Number one, your body has disappeared. Because in these jhanas you can't feel you at all. Your body is completely gone. That's why those states of mind liberation, if a person gets reborn as a result of those states in those realms, those are the realms, they're called the Brahmaloka, where there is no more gender. Gender is in some of the Buddhist heaven realms, but in those jhana realms, that's where there's no gender left, because gender is about your body. And here we're talking about your mind. When you get into the jhana states, the experience of female jhana, the male jhana, is where we have the same. In the realm of the mind, there is no gender difference. Gender is about body. And the emotions which are dependent upon that body. For when you get into the mind, there is no gender left anymore. That's where we meet. So this is, the body has disappeared. Gender identity has disappeared. The ability to feel the body, to hear, to see, is all gone. It's not as if you can turn it on again if you want to. It's taken away from you in these jhanas. And one of the most interesting things which have disappeared is your ability to choose, to will, to do things. Now, you're there watching, but you can't do anything anymore. Something which you always thought was there, your ability to control your environment, your ability to control yourself, even to think what you want, it's all been taken away. You couldn't think at all, even if you wanted to. It's all gone. It's impermanent. That which does, the doer, the controller, the one in charge of you, has been impermanent, is gone. Now those experiences are really quite threatening. But they are real. Therefore, is where you gain insight. Not the insight which you get ordinarily just from thinking about things, but the insight you get from weird experiences. Experiences which challenge your basic assumptions on who you are. Impermanence, and also fading away. You've seen things fade away, disappear, like the television set, just fading. The other simile I give is like watching the waves on the ocean. Waves go up, waves go down. Even the ocean goes up and goes down with the tides. But that's not fading away. It's not the next thing which comes up is cessation. You're watching the waves on the ocean go up and down. And one day you're watching those waves go up and down and the whole ocean disappears. Together with all the mountains which hold it and define it. The whole lot has vanished. It's not there anymore. Now that's what we mean by impermanence. Fading away and cessation. See, all these things have stopped. Things which you always thought were there. Things which you thought had to be there to give a foundation to your very existence have now gone. And the last one is relinquishment. These things have been relinquished anyway, or rather, they have relinquished you. You have been left behind. You have disappeared. It's part of you that's not been in there when those experiences have been happening. And this is where you get the insights into impermanence, into non-self, and through the experiences of those beautiful blisses, to know that with that relinquishment is the greatest happiness. These are bliss states which will blow you away. Well, that TV series said that that Tibetan monk was the happiest person they'd ever met. When I saw that tape, the fellow still had his eyes shut, eyes open. He's been disappointed. I don't think he was in jhana. If they put a monk in jhana in that machine, that would really sort of go off the scale. Way off the scale, the blisses of those days. And then you would realize that you too are the happiest person in the world when you've relinquished so much. That's why relinquishing is only relinquishing suffering. Monks, this is how mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated. So it is of great fruit and great benefit. Any questions on that? Yes, Nicholas. Correct. Those reflections have to have some data on which you reflect, some experiences, some interesting, not abnormal experiences, in order to really challenge and really to grow and understand what's really truthful. If a person, the old simile of the tadpole, always born in the water, lived in the water, spent all their life in the water, they need experiences of life outside of their domain to actually know what water really is, and to get fascinating experiences of life beyond water. And this is where we get to understand the life beyond the body, life beyond me, something beyond. And those experiences which happen in those jhanas, afterwards, it's almost inevitable. That's why a lot of this stuff is all natural, it happens anyway. It's almost inevitable that a person would look back upon some of those experiences and say, what was that? Why was that? And as they look more and more, that's called reflecting. As they reflect more and more, then they understand more and more of these things. They've seen a television set disappear. What the heck was that? They have to investigate. So this is what they do after they emerge from those beautiful states. Does that answer your question? Yeah, go on. Aha, yeah. Yeah, I think this is the doer creates non-stillness. That's the cause of actually moving. The world is by nature still. Because we interrupt the world, it becomes, it trembles. Sorry? What is the doer? In a word, stupidity. Absolutely. But if we know non-stillness, then we can experience it. Otherwise, it's sometimes for people who haven't experienced it, it's completely non-tangible. Because you can't get hold of it, because you want to grasp it. It has to be something coming from letting go, not from grasping. The old simile, I cannot, no matter how hard I try, hold this cup still. If I'm holding it, it will never be still. Even if I really concentrate and practice for years, there's always some trembling. But I can very easily make this cup still as soon as I put it down, I let it go. When I put it down on there, that's going to be still very soon. When I'm holding it and doing it, it's always some trembling. With doing, there's always trembling. With letting go, eventually it comes to stillness. It's clinging, it's when there's a self, there's a me in there, we want to do things. And it's so hard not to do anything. In fact, doing is a way of expressing yourself. And so we always do things in life. When we have a weekend off, we say, what are you doing this weekend? And you think we're dead if we don't do anything. In fact, that's usually how you test if a person's dead or not, whether they do things. You poke them and see if they do something. If they don't, you think they're dead. That's why sometimes when you get in these jhanas, people think you're dead. Because as far as medicine's concerned, it's like you're dead. You're not doing anything, absolutely still, like a corpse. But you're not dead. You're just a doer's dead. So, doing is being. You know that old saying? That was it, I think it was Descartes said, is that to do is to be. That's what we're saying, because that's existence, is known by reacting to things, doing things. And Jean-Paul Sartre turned that around and said, no, it's not to do is to be is to do. He was the existentialist. Existence came first, being, and then doing. And then that was all summed up, as you know, by the great American philosopher who put it all together, dooby-dooby-doo. And that was Frank Sinatra. I can't resist old jokes. when I was a student, that was actually written on as graffiti in Cambridge University on the philosophy department wall. I always remember that. Yeah. What's interesting, when there is like a heart failure, sometimes with a person, their body dies for a small, short time. And what is death anyway? Is when you let go of your body. And when the senses stop working. And so when a person dies, it's like going into these stages of you've read over here. The breath disappears. When a person leaves the body, it's always a pleasant experience. Ask anyone who's had an out-of-the-body experience, and they usually say it's one of the most pleasant experiences of their life. Or rather, of their death. It's because that in all letting go, there's always a letting go of attachments, letting go of ourselves, because this is how we define ourselves. And we get used to this, and this is attachment to our places and things which define us. Especially when we get into these jhanas, we're letting go of our body and our ability to choose. And if you think that you are the one who's in control of all of this, and that's what you're attached to, the controller, the doer, then it's frightening. When I was a kid, growing up in sort of a Christian society, in the movies, the worst thing which could happen to somebody was the devil taking over your mind. taking over your choice, letting go of, you know, that's what they used to say, you know, that will you sell your soul to the devil? And I always say these days, having known what actually this soul business is, and know there's nothing there, I very willingly sell my soul to the devil. If it raises some money for the Buddhist Society, there's nothing there. We always get the best deal. But there's nothing there at all. But that's only a joke. It's when you think there's something there, and you're about to lose it, that's what's called fear. All fear is about to lose, or thinking you're going to lose, an attachment, something which is very dear to you. So does that answer your question, sort of?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No. It's after the mind is unliberated. You liberate the mind into jhanas and afterwards. Come afterwards, yeah. Winding down, yeah. Have those beautiful experiences. Within the jhanas, anyone who's ever experienced those states would know from their own experience that you cannot think or do anything in those states. The doer has disappeared. There's no controller. You're just sitting there. Which is why some people go into these states for long periods of time and they miss all their appointments. They can't do anything about it. They're just having a great time. You lose all track of time, all track of your body, all track of the world outside. Having a wonderful time. Thank you very much. And only afterwards, when it's time to come out, you come out. And afterwards, that's when you do all these contemplations. Any other questions on this? Yeah. Yes, in the sense that this is a natural abiding. If you're going to go home, you have to. Step number one has to be getting up off your cushion. Step number two has to be going through the door over there. Step number three, you have to turn left and turn right. Step number four, you have to go, you know, out of the door there. Step number five, you have to get to your car. Six, you've got to open the door of the car. Seven, you've got to put the car key in or something. It is like a natural progression of things which happen. And this is actually why that you don't have to do all those steps in the sense of the first two steps, breathing in or breathing out. So breathing long or breathing short, those are alternatives. There has to be a sense of, was it knowing the whole breath and then sort of calming the breath and then bringing joy up, sort of calming the joy, or experiencing the whole happiness, then calming it all until the nibbana arises. Sometimes those stages can happen very rapidly. And if they happen rapidly, all to the good. If you start to get the nimitta up, sometimes it's bright enough, you don't need to do the tenth step of brightening up the mind. Sometimes it's steady enough, you don't need to do studying that nimitta. It's natural. Sometimes it just happens automatically, you go straight into a jhana. But if you notice through experience, you always go through those stages, sometimes rapidly, but you go through them. Because all the stages of letting go, first of all, for mindfulness, you're letting go of thought, you're letting go of time to get mindful of the present moment, to get onto the breath, you're letting go of everything else in the world. And when you let go of the breath, you're letting go of your body and all the other senses. When you get this happiness and joy, this is actually just how you let go of the body. When you get the nimitta coming up, you let go of everything else. You've only got that mind, the body's completely disappeared. By that time, sound is very difficult to hear. You can't feel your body at all. You don't know what your legs are doing. When you go into the jhanas, you let go a little bit more. And to go further through the jhanas, it's more letting go. Okay, let's carry on. Paragraph 23. Fulfillment of the four foundations of mindfulness. Now, for those of you who've got experience in other traditions, especially in the Theravada Buddhist tradition, you see many, many times that people go along and say Satipatthana is the vipassana practice. Four foundations of mindfulness, they equate to vipassana. You've heard that many times. Now here we're getting the Buddha saying Anapanasati, leading to jhanas, so-called samatha meditation, fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. Fulfills Satipatthana practice. So we're saying here's anapana is vipassana. No different. So people say you can either do samatha or vipassana. The Buddha's saying here anapanasati fulfills the four satipatthanas. Anapanasati fulfills vipassana. Please remember that. So there's none of this dividing, do you do samatha, do you do vipassana, do you do this anapana, do you do four foundations of mindfulness. The Buddha's saying here, do four foundations of mindfulness by or through doing meditation on the breath. And how amongst this mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated fulfill the four foundations of mindfulness? Monks, on whatever occasion, a monk breathing in long understands I breathe in long, or breathing out long understands I breathe out long, breathing in short understands I breathe in short, breathing out short understands I breathe out short, or trains thus I shall breathe in experiencing the whole body of breath, trains thus I shall breathe out experiencing the whole body of breath, trains thus I shall breathe tranquilizing the bodily formation, trains thus I shall breathe out tranquilizing the bodily formation. The first four steps, watching the breath, calming it down. On that occasion, a monk abides contemplating the body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. I say this is a certain body among the bodies, namely in-breathing and out-breathing. That is why on that occasion a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. So on those occasions when you're watching the breath, that, the Buddha saying, fulfills body contemplation. Bhikkhus, paragraph 25. On whatever occasion a bhikkhu trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture, trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing rapture, trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing pleasure, trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing pleasure, trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the mental formation, this is pleasure and rapture, trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the pleasure and rapture, trains thus, I shall breathe in tranquilizing the pleasure and rapture. Trains thus, I shall breathe out tranquilizing the pleasure and rapture, the mental formation. On that occasion, a monk abides contemplating Vedana, the feelings. Ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. I say that this is a certain Vedana, feeling among feelings, namely giving close attention to in-breathing and out-breathing, here meaning the pleasure, giving the attention to the pleasure of this. That is why on that occasion a bhikkhu abides contemplating feelings, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. You can see that this is what the Vedana is here, the pleasure and joy, which becomes the main focus of attention at this stage of Anapanasati. As I mentioned before, at this stage you're not watching the breath, you're watching the pleasure. That's what you're mostly aware of. That's why it's under the second Satipatthana. That's why the Buddha said it is the feeling of the breath at this stage, not the breath itself, not the body, but how it appears at this stage. Okay, carry on. Paragraph 26. Monks, on whatever occasion a bhikkhu trains us, I shall breathe in experiencing the mind. Trains us, I shall breathe out experiencing the mind. That's the limit at this stage. Trains us, I shall breathe in gladdening the mind. Trains us, I shall breathe out gladdening the mind. This is shining up, making it brilliant. Trains us, I shall breathe in concentrating or stabilizing is much better, the mind. Trains thus, I shall breathe out, stabilizing the nimitta, concentrating the mind, it says here. Trains thus, I shall breathe in, liberating the mind. Trains thus, I shall breathe out, liberating the mind. On that occasion, a monk abides contemplating mind, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. I do not say there is the development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is forgetful, who is not fully aware. That is why on that occasion a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind as mind, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. One is forgetful and not fully aware. Forgetful means lack of mindfulness. The Buddha is actually saying here that this particular stage of when you are focusing on the mind, when you are looking at the nimitta or liberating the mind in these jhanas, this is not an occasion of forgetfulness, or rather lack of mindfulness. It's not an occasion of not being fully aware. You are fully aware, but of such a limited experience of the world that it's a completely different type of mindfulness and awareness. This is super mindfulness, super awareness, but focus on a small amount of the world. And sometimes people think that in the jhanas you're letting go of your mindfulness. Certainly you're not mindful of the breath. You're not mindful of the body. You're not mindful of the doer, of what you're doing, because all those things have disappeared. Here you're mindful of the mind. That fills your consciousness, especially the bliss of the mind, are the major objects in the jhana. So this is why, number one, it contemplates as mind contemplation, because you're watching the mind, and why the Buddha says these things. I do not say there is the development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is forgetful, who is not fully aware. This mindfulness is even more intense in this place. Yeah? Hindrances, yes. Correct, yes. Yes. Now, I think when the if it gets to the nimitta stage, the five hindrances are pretty well suppressed, 99% suppressed. Just need a little bit more, but mostly suppressed at that stage. Yeah. Not necessarily, because now actually you can contemplate those things after the jhanas, which is where you do the contemplations, so that we have that data there of what the nimitta was, of what the breath was, and then you can actually start to contemplate them afterwards. Does that make sense to you? Okay. Remember, the Satipatthana itself is actually the I might say the process rather than the results. It's the experiment rather than the conclusion. Yeah. Fulfillment, yes. I'm seeing what you mean, yes, yeah. Ah, I see what you mean, yeah, because where you're doing the body contemplation, you may actually say there that because that body contemplation, because the whole thing has been done, the whole of the Anapanasati, not just the first four, the eight, but the whole 16 steps have been done, but as a result of that, you know, you've got to stages where the hindrances have gone. So it's not just saying that by just doing the first four stages. I think you can actually say that you need to do the whole of the 16 stages to really fulfill the Satipatthana. Can be, yes, but it's also using memory of like mindfulness, of actually being able to take up that experience, which, you know, say like after jhana, take up the first parts of your meditation practice of just the breath and being able to focus on that. Yeah. So like using memory, just this is what, like the experimenter does, you got on the information or the data and then you look back upon it. What was that? How was that? Especially, you know, you had the breath, now you know the breath has disappeared. So therefore, you can actually realize just what the breath really is. You can see the body, now you've seen the body gone. So that's enough of a good experience of the body, now you can actually see what the body's gone to realize that the body is impermanent, fades away, cessation. Yeah. Looking back afterwards, because when you're actually doing these nimittas, you're just gaining the data, gaining the experience, and it's only afterwards, especially the last four, you really do your contemplations. You would almost say that, yeah, because again, it's the Satipatthana. It's whether you're using the Satipatthana as the goal or whether the path. If you're talking about using the Satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness, you're being mindful of these things, of these experiences, you're gaining the data of them, And then after the experience, when the hindrances are all gone, after the jhanas, then you could say they have been fulfilled. Because only at that time, when the hindrances are completely gone, you can look back upon where you've come from, your whole journey. It's as if, a good example of this is, you know, when you're walking up a mountain, you go through the plains, you go through the forest, you go up to the through the snow, now you're sitting on top of the mountain, and only at that time you can look down, and you look what the plains were, what the forest were, what the snow was, what the scree was from that situation. So in a sense, it's only when the whole thing is finished, you can say the whole thing has been fulfilled. But that's enough to actually have a walk through that forest, to have fulfilled, got enough data to actually fulfill the purposes of the practice of that fourth Satipatthana, the first Satipatthana or the second Satipatthana. But for it to come to its real fulfillment is when it teaches you the wisdom. So it's as if you've got enough information. It's like you've done all the courses at university, you've done the exams, so that, in a sense, has fulfilled that course, but you haven't got your degree yet. So in a sense it's fulfilled, in a sense, you know, you've just got to wait until you get the convocation and the piece of paper, and it's really fulfilled. No, I think you need the four. At least you need the third foundation. That's the most important one of the jitta. And the first. I think you probably need the first and the third for sure. You actually need the four, basically. Yeah. That's right, it's one of the hiding places. So this is... I don't want to go too much into Satipatthana, because that's another talk altogether. But the reason why there's four Satipatthana, and just those four, is because those are the places where people usually build up a sense of self and identity, of me and mine. Yeah. Yeah, well, it doesn't mean that at all. If you've heard me talk before, I never translate those terms in that way. If I was focusing on the Satipatthana here, I already mentioned, no one actually brought this up so far, that when I was reading this out, bhikkhus on whatever occasion a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body, ardent, fully aware, in the text it says body is body. And you've heard me say before, that is a very bad translation. That is just because of the original people who started translating never really understood Pali. It's just the idiom. It never means body is body. It's just a way of Pali. You always do body contemplation on the body. Where else would you do body contemplation but on the body? It's just those particular verbs always take its own object. You do path sweeping on the path. You do pastry cooking of pastries. So in English you cook pastries, but in Pali you do pastry cooking pastries. That's just the idiom of Pali. And that comes out here, they say, you do body contemplation on the body. You do feeling contemplation on feeling. It's just the idiom of the Pali which has been badly translated. And because it was translated years and years ago, and because Theravada Buddhism is so conservative, so very few people want to change it. And the same as covetous and grief for the world, that was the original translation of Lokeya Bija Dhammanasang, which was first started by Professor Rice Davids about over 100 years ago, and it's stuck and no one dares to change it, but it's quite clear it means having abandoned the first two hindrances in particular, which means desire for the five senses and ill will. Grief for the world is Dhammanasa, literally means bad mind. And it's a synonym in Pali for ill will to anything, the second hindrance. But because I didn't want to complicate it with the thing on the Satipatthana, I just glossed over that. Yeah? What is nimitta? What a nimitta is something which arises in your meditation. It's a mental object. So it's not seen through the eyes, not heard through the ears, not smelt through the nose, tasted through the tongue, not felt in the body. When all those five senses calm down, the sixth sense of mind has a chance to manifest, and that's usually manifested as a light which appears in the mind. Most people experience that like a car headlight shining in your face, but your eyes are closed, you're not sort of in the middle of the road, or like seeing the sun or the moon. There are all sorts of different nimittas. When the mind is not that stable, you can have like point nimittas, like stars in the sky. You can have flashing nimittas. Sometimes you have firework nimittas, like watching the sky show. Those are not good ones because it's just too complicated. Sometimes people can see whole sceneries, like, you know, fields or rolling hills, and those aren't really good ones because that's just, again, too complicated. So it's the simple ones, the simple nimittas, are the ones which in meditation is what we usually go for. So these are like mental experiences, pure mind experiences, when everything else has disappeared. Doesn't matter because remember, this is not seen through the eye. So usually what happens is it might be a favorite color or color which for you means something to you. And really the color is completely irrelevant to the experience. However, because this is just what perception does, it fills in the details. And so as we add through our perception a color to these things. And it really doesn't matter what color it is. It can be gold, it can be blue, it can be orange, yellow. It doesn't matter what color it is. So when people come and they say they've seen these beautiful lights, it doesn't really matter what color it is. If it's many colors, I say that's too complicated. If it's just a single color, whatever color it is, say it's a blue color, it's the most beautiful, rich blue you've ever seen. An unearthly blue, nothing you can actually see in this world because it's just too deep and too rich. Because it's seeing with the mind, not with the eyes. Yeah. No, not at all. No, not at all. And sometimes you might see different colours, completely unrelated. Because it's just what you add, and you can add a different color any time you want. Sometimes it's what you expect it to be. But it doesn't really matter. The color is completely unimportant. What's important is the stability and its brilliance and beauty. So we just make it so simple that whatever color it is, not important. Correct, yeah. Correct, yes. There's nothing to do. No, not at all. Okay. And we got paragraph 27. On whatever occasion a monk trains us, I shall breathe in contemplating impermanence, breathe out contemplating impermanence. On whatever occasion, breathing in or breathing out, contemplating fading away, contemplating cessation, contemplating relinquishment. On that occasion, a monk abides contemplating mind objects. Ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. I'm going to change it to what it should be. Having seen with wisdom the abandoning of the five hindrances, they look on closely with equanimity. This is where you can really look on with equanimity. That is why on that occasion a monk abides contemplating mind objects. Ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. So this is the fourth satipatthana. This is where you're contemplating the mind objects. Monks, this is how mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. How anapanasati fulfills satipatthana, fulfills vipassana. And how monks of the four foundations of mindfulness developed and cultivated fulfill the seven enlightenment factors. The seven enlightenment factors, a very ancient way of explaining the path to enlightenment and what happens at enlightenment. These are the factors of enlightenment and also the ingredients of enlightenment. So when you cultivate each one of these and put them all together, that's called enlightenment. On whatever occasion a monk abides contemplating the body, ardent, fully aware, mindful, having putting away the five hindrances, on that occasion unremitting mindfulness is established. On whatever occasion unremitting mindfulness is established in the monk, on that occasion the mindfulness enlightenment factor is aroused, they develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment. Abiding thus mindful, they investigate and examine that state with wisdom and embark upon a full inquiry into it. On whatever occasion abiding thus mindful, a monk investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks on a full inquiry into it. On that occasion, the investigation of states, the Dhamma Vicaya, enlightenment factor is aroused in them, and they develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment. In one who investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks upon a full inquiry into it, tireless energy is aroused. One is interested, therefore one gets energy. On whatever occasion, tireless energy is aroused in the Dhamma, aroused in a monk who investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks upon a full inquiry into it. On that occasion, the energy enlightenment factor is aroused in them, and they develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment. In one who has aroused energy, unworldly rapture arises. On whatever occasion unworldly rapture arises in a monk who has aroused energy, on that occasion the rapture enlightenment factor is aroused in them, and they develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment in them. So I mentioned many times, from energy, mental energy, is happiness. The rapture and the energy, they come together. In one who is rapturous, the body and the mind become tranquil. This is that inner happiness, the contentment. The body is still. That's why you can sit quietly in meditation, not even moving. And the mind becomes still. In one who is rapturous, the body and the mind become tranquil. On whatever occasion the body and the mind become tranquil in a monk who is rapturous, on that occasion the tranquility enlightenment factor is aroused in them. And they develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment. In one whose body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated, enters samadhi. On whatever occasion the mind becomes concentrated in a monk whose body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, on that occasion the concentration enlightenment factor, this is samadhi, is aroused in them, and they develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment in them. This is jhanas, tranquility and pleasure. One closely looks on with equanimity at the mind thus concentrated, and this is the last Satipatthana. On whatever occasion a monk closely looks on with equanimity at the mind thus concentrated, on that occasion the equanimity enlightenment factor is aroused in them, and they develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment. In paragraph 37, the same with developing the Satipatthana on feelings, mind, and mind objects. So, this is how the four foundations of mindfulness developed and cultivated fulfill the seven enlightenment factors. And how amongst the seven enlightenment factors developed and cultivated fulfill true knowledge and deliverance? Here, a monk develops the mindfulness enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, and ripens in relinquishment. He develops investigation of states, energy, rapture, tranquility, concentration, equanimity, each one supported by seclusion, dispassion, cessation, which ripen in relinquishment. That is how the seven enlightenment factors developed and cultivated fulfill true knowledge and deliverance. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied, delighted in the Blessed One's words. The seven enlightenment factors, not only the way, mindfulness, investigating Dhamma, energy, getting the rapture up, the tranquility, the samadhi, the jhana, and the equanimity, letting go of craving, attachments, equanimous. They come one after the other in succession. When they all come together, that is another description of enlightenment. And that is why they develop the seven enlightenment factors, which develops enlightenment itself. I went through those last ones very quickly, as I went through the beginning very quickly, because this was a talk not on the seven enlightenment factors or on the Satipatthana, but on the Anapanasati Sutta in particular. And that's why I focused on Anapanasati, even though they had those bookends at the beginning and the end, which I rushed through. So, the Anapanasati is the Buddha's teaching, especially on meditation. It's not just on the breath, it starts with the breath, it's in the middle of the breath, the middle is part of the breath, but it goes on into the jhanas, into the insight practices. And it's why this, the practice which the Buddha used was Anapanasati, and how it fulfills all of the practices which are necessary for enlightenment. So, has anyone got any questions or comments on that? Because we've gone over time again. We're supposed to finish at 4:15 and already some people had to go out because they had other appointments. That's why, again, I rushed through it a little bit. Hope you don't mind me rushing through. Okay, you got a question, or is it? Yeah. One last question, then we finish off. Was there a question? No. No, maybe you can come up afterwards and ask a question on a different area, because otherwise it gets too late. I've already had a request for the next one, even though in 2 weeks, unfortunately, I won't be here to give the Dharma class, one of the other monks will. But the next one I will do will be the Upakalesa Sutta, which is, that was a request from one of the people here. Now, I know it's in here somewhere. Does anyone know where it is? Thank you very much. And he was the one who asked for it. So if anyone doesn't like it, he's the one to blame. Upakalesa Sutta. And it actually, it's a good sutta to talk about after the Anapanasati Sutta, because these show some of the impediments, the obstructions to fulfilling the Anapanasati, especially those very, very fine obstructions when you get into stages of nimittas and things like that. So that's a lovely sutta for me to talk about after doing the Satipatthana. Upakalesa, sutta number 128. Okay, let's pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and then we could go and do our thing. And John, you can come up and ask that question. Maybe do it quickly then. Yeah, go. No, never. We may die before the other time comes. If you have to go, you can go, but if not, ask the question. Yeah? Oh, that question, yeah. Allah Kalama to Karam Buddha. Yes, okay. Okay, very good question. This is a common question, a very simple answer. There is a problem there. It's a contradiction which needs to be resolved, because certainly the Buddha was looking back. The only other time he did experience dharmas was a young boy under the rose apple tree. But he'd had those experiences under Uttaka Ramaputta and Alara Kalama, of those so-called immaterial states. How can we reconcile that? The theory which I've been proposing, which a few monks sort of accept, is that those states, the immaterial attainments of nothingness and other perception, non-perception, which were taught by Uttaka Ramaputta and Alara Kalama, were not the real thing. In the same way that even these days that people come along and they teach jhanas, they're not the real jhanas. Much less than the real jhanas. It's as if, and this actually is repeated elsewhere in other examples in the suttas, it's as if that those teachings, they were from a long, long time ago from the previous Buddha, still repeated, they've got still some idea of what those were, but not the full thing. And as such, that they had the words of nothingness, they had the words of neither perception or non-perception, but the actual attainments which were experienced by those teachers and which were taught to the future Buddha were not the same as the real experiences which were based on jhana which came afterwards. They were in name but not in essence. And that has got a lot of support by some of the monks now, because the Buddha said elsewhere, especially the state of nothingness is conducive towards full enlightenment. At the time he said it wasn't. So it was another state. Had the name, but wasn't the real thing. In the same way that sometimes you can go off to some teachers these days and they get a little bit of happiness in the meditation, they say, oh, that's the first jhana. But listen, it's not the first jhana. The first jhana is far deeper than that. So they have the name, but not the real experience. Usually after time, those experiences get, the entry requirements get less and less and less, just as like in universities. What you actually need to get into university, the entry requirements gets less and less. What you need to gain a degree gets less and less and less. Remember, in medieval Europe, to get a PhD, a doctor, Only for each university, maybe one PhD was given every 5 or 10 years. Only one. So you really had to be just a top-notch genius to get a PhD. And now people can get PhDs very relatively easy. And to get even a bachelor's degree, which is so hard. But as things get popular, standard gets down. So, you know, you might say, just, you know, when I was a young monk, you know, really enlightenment was really something. These days, you get the idea there. And I think that's probably the solution to that problem. Otherwise, there's no other cogent solution. Okay, so let's pay respect to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, then we can go and have a cup of tea. Or if you're a monk, you go back to your monastery.
Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakkato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savakkasangho Sanghang Namami.